ever since the death of Stalin some 3 years ago, the rulers of the Soviet Union have been engaged in a campaign to make friends in the democratic world. In the days of Stalin, the rulers of Russia were engaged in the campaign to subvert the democratic world. And this, in my judgment, what has been taking place in the last few years represents a fundamental change. And even if one maintains that it is only a change in tactics and method and does not represent a change in ultimate objectives, it is still an important and significant change. For tactics and methods have a way of integrating themselves in ultimate objectives, and therefore have an intrinsic value of their own. And sometimes tactics are more important than ultimate objectives, which are really seldom attained. Means and methods have a way of determining the fabric of the ultimate outcome of affecting the final result. So that even if that which has taken place recently in the Soviet Union represents only a change in methods, an approach, that too is tremendously significant. Bulganin and Khrushchev, in visiting India and Burma and Afghanistan and more recently Great Britain, were not out to communize or Sovietize these countries, or in some subtle and conspiratorial manner to undermine their institutions and their accustomed way of life. They're really not as naive as all that. They were out to make friends for Russia, to create new markets for Russian trade, and to end a long period of isolation, which its own threatening revolutionary ideology and its own technique of subversion had imposed upon the Soviet Union. It is true that they had previously talked about the possibility of coexistence between capitalism and communism, but only by way of an argument when hard pressed, or by way of a formal reassurance of the Western world in a certain specific emergency. But now they are in dead earnest about it. They want this coexistence badly, and they're making supreme efforts to assure it. Not so much as a means to something else, but as an end in itself, something which is urgently needed, desperately wanted by the peoples of the Soviet Union. And so earnest and urgent are they about it that they have done many things in the last few years which were unthinkable prior to that time. They ate humble pie with Tito, you will remember, and called upon him whom they had expelled from their circle and had denounced as a traitor and as an enemy. They called upon him on a mission of reconciliation, and they humbly acknowledged their mistake and solicited that reconciliation. More recently, they abolished and made public announcement of the abolition of the Cominform, this international communist organization which had expelled Tito, and through which communist Russia had channeled much of its international propaganda and subversive activities. But much more astonishing than all this has been the systematic campaign which has been going on in the Soviet Union for some time now to discredit the old Stalinist regime, to downgrade, in fact, to liquidate Stalin himself. He who had been enthroned on high for nearly a generation. The myth of the genius of Stalin, which had been so systematically cultivated in the Union, which was part of the education of every child in the school system of the Union. Stalin as the true heir of Lenin, Stalin as the great economist and theoretician, Stalin as the glorious war leader, all that myth is today almost a heresy in the Soviet Union. 3 years after his death, Stalin is being systematically assassinated. And the present rulers of Russia are publicly beating their breasts in acknowledging not only the errors of the past regime, under which they lived and thrived, and with which they cooperated most closely. But they are acknowledging without shame and without hesitancy the criminal acts of the past generation in the Soviet Union, the unbridled tyranny and terrorism, the miscarriage of justice, the wholesale purges of innocent people, the very crimes with which the free world charged the Soviet Union in the last generation, but which charges and accusations were contemptuously rejected and denied. At the 20th Communist Party Congress last February, Khrushchev himself acknowledged all these crimes of the communist regime. And what a vindication all this is for democracy. And what a vindication of those contentions of the free world coming out of the mouth of the arch-communist himself, not outside of Russia, but inside of Russia. how self-accused and self-condemned are these communists today, not only in the Soviet Union, but all their adherents and defenders and apologists outside. While these Bulganins and Khrushchevs are denouncing the one-man tyranny of Stalin, with which they collaborated, and the crimes which they witnessed with their own eyes, but raised no voice of protest against them, they're also in the same breath really denouncing and repudiating themselves. For what do they suggest as a substitute for the one-man tyranny of Stalin? They have now established a collective tyranny of a half dozen or a dozen men. A tyranny no less thoroughgoing, no less oppressive of basic human rights and freedoms, and no less capable of criminal oppression and criminal abuse than the one-man tyranny of Stalin. This new dictatorial junta, this plural-headed hydra of aristocracy, is now offering the Russian people no freedom of thought or freedom of speech or freedom of assembly, no right of any opposition political party to exist. They're offering the people nothing which we associate with a democratic way of life. They're offering them the delusion of a benefit of a multiple collective dictatorship in place of a unitary dictatorship. Still a self-sufficient and to itself exclusively accountable tyranny, the tyranny of an oligarchy in place of the sole and absolute tyranny of one man, Stalin. Nevertheless, I believe that the world will welcome this change only as it is a portent, only as it is, as it points the way to the next step, and in my humble judgment, inevitably so. The collapse, the ultimate collapse of this collective dictatorship in some unforeseen crisis in the future, which will usher in the next stage of development in the Soviet Union, which will usher in an era when the Russian people will finally rise up to demand, as other peoples have demanded, the rights of free men and the charter of human liberties. This is bound to come. And the first decisive step has been taken, not voluntarily, and perhaps not knowingly of the ultimate consequences. The first step has now been taken. As to the reason behind this radical and startling change, opinions may differ. The best informed opinion seems to be that with the death of Stalin, the circle about him, from which circle his successor had to come, thought it best for themselves, if not for the country, that no single dictator with absolute power should be permitted. In a way, it was a way of ensuring their own survival. For a competition of leadership for the sole exclusive absolute power might have led to strife and to liquidations with which the Russian rulers are very familiar. no single dictator. But on the other hand, no reduction, no limitation of dictatorship in Russia. And therefore, a collective dictatorship. And therefore, the principle of the one-man dictator, to which the Russian people had been habituated, into which they had been educated, had to be discredited. And therefore, the whole Stalin legend, Stalin, who represented the incorporation of the idea of the one-man ruler, the whole legend of Stalin had to be dismantled, had to be destroyed. And so the vast Russian propaganda machine, which reaches every town and village and factory and home in the Union, was put into full operation. And the leaders of Russia know exactly how to manipulate this machine. And now a hero can overnight almost become a villain. They've done that time and again. They've done it with the leaders of the revolution who were liquidated by Stalin and had bullets sent into their heads. They know exactly how one's character can be assassinated and destroyed. The Stalin legend, therefore, is being liquidated. And the authority of the Communist Party as such is being reasserted and reestablished. That authority which it enjoyed under Lenin. And the executive power of this party will now be lodged in a group which will share collective responsibility. The new rulers of Russia now feel that the isolation which Stalin had forced upon Russia is no longer necessary or desirable. They feel that they can best serve the interest of Russia no longer by a program of conspiratorial subversion all over the world or military threats, which really frightened the free world and forced the free world to organize itself against the Soviet Union. But they're now proceeding to employ the methods which are used in the free world, the methods of diplomacy, of friendly contacts between governments and between peoples. They are resolved to win friends for themselves, or keep the neutral, non-committed countries from joining alliances against Russia by extending economic aid to those countries, which Russia is now in position to do, and even if necessary, military aid. They feel that the position of Russia today, the economic position, makes increasing trade with the free world obligatory, imperative. The present rulers of Russia are also less afraid of the free world than was Stalin. They are possessed now of the A-bomb and of the H-bomb, and in regards to other military matters of strength, they feel that they are the equal of countries like the United States. They feel that a war between the East and the West is neither imminent nor likely in the proximate future or at all, and therefore they are moving out more confidently on the international scene. And there are also, and there must be, grave internal pressures within the Soviet Union, which makes a fuller contact with the rest of the world vitally necessary. Now, as they do that which they have set out to do quite deliberately and energetically, they will, I believe, increasingly come to realize the possibilities as well as the limits of their efforts and the limits of their diplomatic victories. They will come to understand the extent to which either belligerency or cajolery can really go in the free world. Now, Bulganin and Khrushchev received a wild and tumultuous welcome in India. India is not a long-established democracy. The people of India are still smarting under the memories of colonial exploitation on the part of Western powers, especially of Great Britain. India, in the present struggle between the East and the West, has adopted a policy of what they call positive neutralism. And India has been sort of cultivating the goodwill of the Soviet Union. And the reception arranged for Bulganin and Khrushchev in India was fostered by the government and perhaps organized by the government. It was a different story altogether when Bulganin and Khrushchev visited an old, tried, hard-headed democracy like Britain, the mother of parliaments. There the reception was not quite as enthusiastic and tumultuous. There, the people were far more critical of their invited guests. Free and organized labor in England, for example, was not swept off its feet by the blandishments of the communist emissaries. For they know from a long experience in trade unionism and from what has taken place in the Soviet Union, they know that communism enshackles labor and does not enfranchise it. The common people of Great Britain were courteous to their invited guests, were distinctly reserved, and were in a mood of critical appraisal of the representatives of the Soviet Union. And Bulganin and Khrushchev did not fail at all to appreciate the significance of all that. The results of the meeting between these leaders and the leaders of Great Britain were limited in scope. The great issues were not decided. Some of them were not even touched upon. The question of the reunification of Germany did not come up. The question of peace and security in Europe was touched upon. But as the joint communique which was issued stated, an understanding on the means to achieve that end was not reached. Nevertheless, the meeting between the leaders of Great Britain and the Soviet Union was not without its value as a contribution to a general relaxation of tensions, a relaxation which is good for the world. The very coming together was a good thing. The exchange of ideas between leaders of governments, however diverse their ideologies may be, an exchange of ideas in a free and frank manner, where the representatives of the governments are not shouting into a microphone for the sake of world propaganda, is highly desirable in these days of strain and tension. A reading of the communique, one or two sentences of it, may help us to understand the gains achieved in terms of attitudes and new approachments and exploration rather than in concrete significant acts. The communique signed by both governments reads, "These talks have been conducted on both sides in a spirit of candor and realism. They have ranged over most of the international questions of current concern, and there has been a full and useful exchange of views. The representatives of the Soviet Union and the United Kingdom recognize that the strengthening of Anglo-Soviet relations in political, trade, scientific, cultural, and other fields would be in the interest of the peoples of both countries. They were also convinced that this would help to consolidate general peace and security. They expressed the determination of their governments to work for a further relaxation of international tensions. Having in view the present situation where there is not the necessary confidence between countries, they express their determination to take all possible measures to facilitate the strengthening of mutual confidence and the improvement of the relations between states. They recognize that one of the important factors in strengthening international confidence consists in personal contacts between leading statesmen, which have produced positive results. The two countries in their relations with each other and also in their relations with other countries will be guided by the principles of the United Nations. They are convinced that the basis of friendly cooperation and peaceful coexistence of all countries, irrespective of their social systems, is respect for national independence and sovereignty, territorial integrity, and non-interference in the internal affairs of others." Perhaps the most significant of the matters discussed of immediate importance, and perhaps the one upon which some conclusions were reached, had to do with the Middle East, with the Near East, with Israel, and its relation with the Arab world. You will recall that last September, Czechoslovakia, member of the Russian bloc, shipped vast quantities of armament to Egypt, and thereby created an imbalance of military strength vis-a-vis the Arabs in Israel and caused grave apprehensions in Israel and brought the prospect of war nearer This issue was thoroughly canvassed in these meetings, and they arrived at some conclusions. I again read from the communique. The United Kingdom and the Soviet Union have the firm intention to do everything in their power to facilitate the maintenance of peace and security in the Near and Middle East. For this purpose, they will give the necessary support to the United Nations in its endeavor to strengthen peace in the region of Palestine and to carry out the appropriate decisions of the Security Council. The governments of the two countries consider that effective measures should be undertaken in the immediate future to this end, in accordance with the national aspirations of the peoples concerned, with the necessity of ensuring their independence and in full conformity with the principles expressed in the Charter of the United Nations. The governments of the two countries call on the states concerned to take measures to prevent and increase the increase of tension in the area of the demarcation line established in accordance with the relevant armistice agreement between Israel and the Arab states. They will also support the United Nations in an initiative to secure a peaceful settlement on a mutually acceptable basis of the dispute between the Arab states and Israel. They recognize the importance of the problem of the refugees and accordingly will support action of the United Nations directed towards the alleviation of their hardships. The governments of the two countries express the strong hope that other states will also do everything possible to help the United Nations in bringing about a peaceful solution of the dispute between the Arab states and Israel, and thus to strengthen peace and security in the Near and Middle East. The importance of that, of course, is the fact that the Soviet Union places itself on record as favoring a peaceful solution in the Near East, and not as an ally, an all-out ally, in support of the Arabs, an impression which had been given up to these meetings by these vast shipment of arms to the Arab countries, and an impression which the Arab countries, especially Egypt, took occasion to give white currency to. The Arab peoples had gotten the impression that the Soviet Union was now behind them on any policy which they are likely to pursue and they wish to pursue, and that should they go to war on Israel, the Soviet Union would solidly back them up. This position has now been publicly repudiated by the Soviet Union, and that has helped to clip the wings considerably of the aspirations, the political aspirations of the adventurers in Cairo and in Damascus and in Baghdad and elsewhere. In the interview before he left Great Britain, Bulganin even stated that he is prepared to agree with other of the nations of the world to stop shipping arms to the Middle East altogether. Well, this matter, of course, should be faced with extreme caution. First of all, the shipping of arms to the Near East altogether would leave Israel at a tremendous disadvantage under which it suffers at the moment, this grave imbalance which has been created by the vast acquisition of arms on the part of Egypt. And on the other hand, the question still remains open, what the position of the Soviet Union will be when the question of a final peace settlement comes up. What will Israel be called upon to sacrifice in order to bring about peace in that part of the world? Where will the Soviet Union be at that time? For that matter, there's still the question where Great Britain will be at that time, and the United States. Nevertheless, this new declaration on the part of the leaders of the Soviet Union may be viewed with a certain amount of satisfaction. Was this meeting between Great Britain and the Soviet Union worthwhile? The Soviet Union seems to think so, and Great Britain seems to think so. Secretary of State or Foreign Minister Eden, as the Russians were leaving Great Britain, was interviewed and was asked what he regarded as the results of this meeting, whether it was worthwhile. And this is what he said, and it's very significant what he said. The London discussions could be something very important. They could be the beginning of a beginning. Bulgarin said something at the press conference this morning, which I want to quote because I agree with it so completely. And he's now quoting Bulgarin, "The program, as you see, is a solid one, and there is a good deal to work upon. We, the Soviet people, take the program seriously and will strive to turn it into reality." "Well," said Eden, "so will we. Even if only partly successful, we can contribute thereby to the peace of the world. There are some who think agreements of this kind have often disappointed us in the past. They say there is no use making them. I utterly disagree and want you to understand seriously where I stand in this. As long as I have any responsibility, we shall continue to work for solutions of these questions. For my part, I will not accept a situation where the great powers of the world stand lowering at each other and consume a large part of their wealth on armament expenditure. We have got to do better than that. It may be, I think it is true, that the immediate danger of war has receded, and that is good. Even if it is true, it is not enough. Here is our policy. We are not to be parted from our friends, nor will we abandon our vital interests, but we will seek agreements with all. In the long history of diplomacy, suspicion has done more harm than confidence." I'd like to repeat that sentence. "In the long history of diplomacy, suspicion has done more harm than confidence. Believe me, that is true. We shall follow the policies I have described to you, seeking agreements and promoting friendships. I'm sure this Soviet visit was in tune with this, and that as a result, the world can rest more secure." You may recall that on numerous occasions when I discussed the relationship of the free world with the Soviet Union, I have in my humble way urged constantly, the meeting of minds, the value of conference, of exchange of ideas, not by way of persuading our people to lower their guards, but by way of doing the very things that Prime Minister Eden has in mind. We've got to live together in the same world. There is no choice. The choice is between coexistence or no existence. Would I favor such a meeting between the heads of the Russian government and the heads of our own government? I would. I do not know whether this is the moment, or in 3 months, or in 6 months. But such meetings should be encouraged. Relaxations take place of one kind or another after all such meetings. I read the other day where our own government has now made possible the acquisition on the part of Russia of some 700 items of trade which heretofore had been prohibited. That's all to the good. Open avenues of trade, of commerce, of communication. That's the only way to clear the air. And democracy will not suffer by it. Communism will suffer by it. I have sufficient strength, as is Mr. Eden, as have the British people, the oldest democracy on earth. They have sufficient confidence in the strength of their own institutions, their own ideas, and what democracy can give to people, to meet face to face with the leaders of the communist world, to talk over outstanding issues in detail and piecemeal, and try to lessen tensions and to increase confidence in the world. That's the only way. And so, I do not look, as some do, upon this communist salesman traveling to the democratic countries with terrible apprehensions. Bulganin and Khrushchev didn't carry away from Great Britain Big Ben or Westminster Abbey. They're still there. And I'd like to see democratic salesmen go into communist countries. Perhaps we are on the threshold of a better day after a generation which split the world clear down the center.